Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is the podcast where we still get excited at the flap of the letterbox and display our correspondence on the mantelpiece with a kind of fascination and pride as we attempt to understand the memories, meanings and stories held by picture postcards. I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm delighted to say that my guests are two writers, both award-winning writers, in fact, Claire Mulley and Sarah Hillary. Sarah and Claire, hello and welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Now, Claire Mulley is a historian, or a biographical historian, more precisely, a particular interest in women's stories that might have been forgotten or never brought to light or were too secret to tell. Mm. The Woman Who Saved Children is a biography of controversial Save the Children founder Eglantine Jebb. The Spy Who Loved tells the extraordinary story of Christina Scarbeck, who became the first woman to work for Britain as a special agent during the Second World War. And her latest book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler, looks at Nazi Germany's only two female test pilots, Hannah Reich and Melita von Stauffenberg. And Claire comes to us today with a very blurred and hard-to-read postmark.
Whoa. Yeah, blurring.
Why so hard to read?
You can't meet me. Yes, blurring because I'm moving all the time. No,
I
suppose I would probably consider myself a Londoner as much as anything, but I have lived all over the place. So Sheffield and Indonesia, Jakarta and Poland and Greece. So, yes.
And is that because your work was taking you there or does your work reflect your time in these various places?
Well, it's a bit of both, but I chose my work because I like to travel and move and see things. But I've been hunkered down in Essex for a while now.
Okay, well, we'll consider that to be written on you somehow. Now, Claire, do you still send postcards?
I do. I do like writing. I suppose we're both writers, aren't we? And there's always that thing you get asked these days, do you read on a Kindle or do you like to hold a physical book? It's the physical versus the... And in some ways, I always think that I like to... It seems more direct to type into a computer and for it to come out into someone else's brain. You know, why do we go through this intermediary? Having said that, of course, I love the physical book. You know, I love bodies as well as minds. I like to hold something. So, yes, I send letters and postcards still.
So, and is it that sense? I think when you have to write something physically, there is a bit more thought required because you don't get to cut and paste, you don't get to delete, you have to just plough through it.
Oh, that's right. And also, I suppose as historian, I mean, you may find this as well, when you hold a physical thing, you read the content and you get the words and the meaning. But often it's how hard was that pen pressed on the paper? What kind of ink were they using? Does C really write with green ink? All of those things that tell us something more, the metatext of it, I suppose. So, yes.
Very good.
Stuff.
Yes. I should use that phrase more often, the metatext. I think that is very often what we're actually dealing with. Now, Sarah Hillary's books have been described as dark and thrilling, deft and disturbing, and truly chilling. But I don't feel too unsafe in the booth today. Her heroine, Marnie Rome, is a single-minded, complicated, brilliant detective who has an unfortunate knack of stumbling into some of the nastiest, most troubling crimes. And we have to read them to find out how she deals with it. And Sarah comes to us today with a SK9 postmark?
Yes, the North.
The North.
Stockport-ish, yes, Manchester.
So is that where you grew up?
Yes, I did. Yeah, so Manchester was my big city when I was growing up. And I still consider myself a northerner, I feel. But I've lived via London and now I'm in the southwest in Bath.
So oh, very nice.
Still go home to the North all the time.
And when did you last send a postcard?
When did I last? And to myself from, well, to myself and my son when we were travelling to America, I think, last year. We got into the habit of sending postcards to ourselves when we were away because we've only just recently discovered travelling. And it's such a nice thing to get about a week after you've got home and you're in a bit of a slump and there's a postcard reminding you of the brilliant time you were having 2 weeks ago.
So it was a kind of broken up diary, a bit at a time.
So. Yes.
I do see quite a lot of cards like that when I'm going through big boxes of cards, which I spend too much time doing, where people have not sent the card, but they've been somewhere, particularly for a day trip, and they'll write, went for a day trip with Bill here and the date. And they've obviously kept it as a little specific dated memento. But I think, yeah, it's another function of postcards as well as sending them.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, before we discover the cards that Sarah and Claire have brought along, I'll give you a quick one of mine. This is, of course, a postcard from the past card, like I do on Twitter, at Past Postcard. It's an old card from which I've taken just a part of the message. And this one, well, here you are. This is the Northwest, Blackpool. And
oh, look at that. Brilliant.
Yeah. What kind of blue you call that
such
in the sky?
Such a natural sky colour,
1970s blue.
Yeah. Yes. But normally it's paler, because normally they're daytime shots.
And normally it's raining. It's Blackpool. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, anyway, these are the trams, the illuminated trams that go up and down the front at Blackpool. And it says Blackpool's illuminated tram cars. And this was sent in, it's not as old as you'd think. It's 1977, it's quite a long time ago. And it was sent to Walsall in the West Midlands by someone called Mark. And like a lot of these, what interests me, I suppose, is the fact that you feel like you are just glimpsing a bit of a story. And he says, "Weather is dry but cold. I have had a dog bite on my nose and had to go to the hospital."
Cracking. So, classic.
That was Mark's experience of Blackpool. I don't know if that happened at night on a tram, possibly did. Another quick one. This is a bit older, actually. This is 1967. The Summer of Love. I don't know if it reached Ipswich. It might have done. And this is a very washed out picture of some of the older buildings in Ipswich in the High Street. And it was sent to Gravenhurst in Bedfordshire by someone called Pat. And they say, "June, Beryl and I went to Enid's house last night for a Tupperware party."
They've got to be aunts, haven't they?
It says
Beryl and Enid.
June, Beryl, well, old friends, I don't know. And then she said, "It seems strange walking down the road where I used to live 12 years ago." So
that's a jumping off point. You could write a novel off
you
that.
Could.
You could.
Yeah.
Where's the crime?
Yes.
I don't know if it's nasty enough for you.
I don't know. Beryl is a good name. I think they went
to see Enid, but no one saw her since.
There's 50p for you if you get Beryl into your next book for me.
You know, the Tupperware, you could hide all sorts in that.
Yes.
Noses bitten off.
Have you written in the past or are your books contemporary?
My books are all contemporary at the moment.
But and very, I've written short very, very modern, aren't they, on the whole?
They are. They're set in contemporary London. But I have written a lot of short stories set in the past. So, I may revisit.
But not as short as these.
No, not as short as those.
They're like park benches, aren't they, where you get that tiny little snapshot.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Bert sat here. He hated it. It tells you so much.
That's all you need to, and that's always summed up to in the end, any of us. Just to let you know, images of all the cards we discussed today are on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can see that we're not making it up. Now, Claire and Sarah, you've been both kind enough to come along with postcards. I know this for a fact. Claire, let's start with you. What's the first card you'd like to share with us?
Well, it's a very precious personal bit of family history for me here. It's a postcard that was made of a photograph taken in 1916 of a group of young men who are serving in Egypt in the First World War, sent to my grandfather by one of his mates who features in that.
And do you know which one he is?
Yeah, I think this one is Joe.
So he's sort of tall on the left of the picture?
Yeah. And it's sent to my grandfather was Sapper Smith, Alfred Smith. You couldn't get a more modest name than A. Smith.
Oh. Family history research quite difficult.
Yeah, but I love that. I love that anonymity sort of feeling with it as well. It says,
yes, it could be anyone.
Yes, exactly. The everyman. 16th of July, 1916. Dear Alf, we're off to France tomorrow morning. So my address for a time will be bloody blah, signals advance base. BEF. What I really love about it is the next line. We've been christened the Stop the War Draft, so good luck to us, eh, Joe?
Stop the War Draft.
I know, it feels
so
like
a draft
the
would
the
be
war
because they've been drafted
today.
In because they're conscripts.
That's right.
And they consider themselves to be the. Is it Stop the War by winning so quickly? Or?
Or, well, yes, it's interesting. You could. It's like when someone paints a picture, as soon as it's off in the air, it's open to interpretation by everyone, isn't it? But considering that he was a good close friend of my grandfather, who was a pacifist, really, but who was very, you know, he served, he went in and did his duty. He actually, when he was in Egypt, he'd just come from Gallipoli, where he was lucky to be in the second lot of landings. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't have survived. But yes, he served out there. And my grandfather he'd worked for the post office. He was a working class man from Yorkshire. And so he'd been drafted into the Royal Engineers Signals because it's about communications, none of those skills were transferable, but it enabled him to do so.
He looked right on the form there.
Exactly. So he joined the cable laying division of the Royal Engineers, and he went out in 1915 towards Gallipoli. And this extraordinary journey, you know, where they would have boxing matches and listen to piano on deck when it was clear, that sort of thing. And then they witness all the shelling and boats being torpedoed. Extraordinary. And then he got out to Gallipoli and he served out there, and he saw many of his friends killed, appalling conditions. And his diaries, I've got his diaries, and they sort of swap between talking about the loss of 8 men and 2 horses behind him to the fact that fruit is available, or that he spends his £1 a week money on cigarettes. There's not a photograph of him without a fag in his mouth.
But that's the stuff of life for a soldier, isn't it?
Well, exactly. It's the prosaic and the terrible side by side. But what I really love is that he kept the things he kept. We don't have that much. We have his cigarette case, which I've brought, tiny little cigarette case, which, of course, he was spending all his money and filling that with fags. A couple of postcards and his diaries. Excuse me. And he kept his medals, but clearly they were in a box. They hadn't been threaded onto their ribbons. That beautiful victory medal of the Winged Lady and all that.
Yes.
They'd never been worn. He'd kept them, but he'd put them away in a drawer. Whereas his photographs, like this postcard, had been framed, and they're all written the names of the guys, his friends, on the back, and a little hook put in so that he could put them at his workplace and look at them after the war.
So the friendships were enduring and real for him.
What mattered for him in the war were the friendships, not the glory of war or any of that. And he always said that his greatest achievement in the First World War was to serve his country without killing anyone. Which
kind of
reflects the message on this postcard of we are the stop the war draft.
So somewhat reluctant, but serving nonetheless.
Well, he wasn't reluctant to play his part. He didn't see that anyone should serve and he should get away with it. You know, he was very keen to put his life on the line in the service of his nation, but he wasn't keen to kill anyone. And in fact, in his diary, you see that in his days off, he goes off and he helps the local people, the Turkish people, to bring in the harvest or to rebuild their houses after shelling. He's an incredibly good, lovely man, but he didn't want to be responsible for taking the life of anyone either.
No, you can understand why he didn't thread those medals or wear them. I think
it's
often the case, isn't it?
It's very telling what you show and what you choose to hold in.
And I think anyone that saw the reality of war up close probably don't see any sort of honour in that sort of the military machine, that side of it. And certainly that's been my experience, my family story.
And I think a lot of people after the First World War wanted to just move on as well if they could, not dwell on those side of things, because they had to try and rebuild their lives.
Yet my grandfather Alf never really spoke with his children, my mother or the family, about his wartime experiences very much. But neither did he destroy that diary. He always kept it safely. So there was always a part of him, just one he chose not to display too much.
Very good. Oh, well, thank you for bringing that in. And it's such a characterful picture as well.
Even
the quality of the light on the bivouacs is...
Yes, it's marvellous. Another one with him with holding a bottle of beer and a chicken, which I quite like. That has been quite a treat day, hence the photograph, I think.
There's something, I look at quite a lot of First World War postcards. It's not a sort of area I'm expert in, but these real photographic ones where they're, you know, actual photographs that have been printed up as postcards, they're quite often slightly ridiculous in that you've got a group of young men having someone point a camera at them, and the first thing they do is misbehave slightly.
Mm. Yes. Well, most of them, you know, a lot of them were very young as well, and they weren't used to having their photograph taken. They'd had a formal portrait taken, perhaps, but these ones they clubbed together and made into postcards. They're all, you know.
Yeah, and you're probably right. To make it, to pay for it, they clubbed together. You're absolutely right, because it was sort of come on a big sheet
with
30 or 40, and they would slice them down, and that would be a way to make it pay. Very good. Oh, thank you very much for that, Claire. Now, I think we're staying with military family history.
Yes, indeed.
So what have you got, Sarah?
So from the First World War to the Second World War.
It's like we planned it.
It is, isn't it? I've got a series of postcards that my grandfather, my mother's father, sent from Batu Lintang prison camp in Kuching in North Borneo, what was then British North Borneo, where he was a civilian internee of the Japanese, along with my grandmother at the age of 25 and their young daughter, my mother, who was 3 when they were interned by the Japanese and 6 when they were liberated by the Australians. And it's a little brown, you know, piece of it. Basically, it's like a piece of brown wrapping paper that you wrap up you cover your textbooks in
it's
school.
The cheapest paper, isn't it?
It is, and the fact that it's survived so beautifully, it's written in pencil, and stamped, passed by the Japanese as being fit to be delivered to Chippenham, which is where my grandfather's father lived. And on the back it says Imperial Japanese Army printed across the top. And then it says, I am interned in, and these are the standard pieces of text, and my grandfather's added to them his own details. So he said he's in a camp in Kuching, in Sarawak. Then the options to, it says, my health is excellent, comma, usual, comma, poor. And he's,
and those are the options you had?
Those were the options you had, and he's crossed out, so that it says, my health is excellent. I am working for pay, he's crossed that out. Oh. I am not working, he's crossed that out. And then it says, please see that, and they've left a space, is taken care of. And he's written in insurance, etc., which is quite chilling, really, when you think about it. And then my love to you, and then there's a space, and he's filled in, and all family. And he wrote that in March 1943, but his father has written on it in fountain pen the date that it was received back in Chippenham in England, which was 18 months later. In December 1944, which is sadly only about 3 months before his son, my grandfather, died in Jesselton Jail in the prison camp. So it was a note that was sent probably under slight duress, but clearly with the intention of reassuring his loved ones that he was fine, and not seen until, you know, very near to the time that he, unbeknownst to most people, died. I mean, it wasn't for a long time.
So that information would have come out even later still.
Even later, yes. And in fact, talking about how, postcards tell stories and letters and artefacts tell stories, I find that this is the story of the prison camp in my family history is definitely one of the main reasons why I became a writer, I feel. Because my grandmother, who obviously she was a young mother in the camp, she had to keep her child alive. They both nearly died several times in the camp, specifically of pneumonia towards the end. She was discouraged. It's interesting what we were saying about people not talking about their wartime experiences. When they were returning from the Far East, the prisoners of the war that ended, of course, a lot later than it did in Europe, were all interviewed by civil servants as they were coming home and instructed not to talk about their war. Really? When they got back to this country, they were told...
What were they hoping to gain by that?
Well, because we were in post-war Britain and it was morale building and nobody wanted to hear about, you know, the depressing experiences of prisoners of war. We were meant to be going towards the Festival of Britain. We were, you know, the Blitz was a memory that people were trying to overcome. Exactly.
I suppose it's necessary, but
yeah,
it's
absolutely
brutal, isn't it?
It is brutal, isn't it? So my grandmother didn't speak about it with her daughter, my mother, because she was grateful for the idea that my mother remembered very little from the camp, because it was a comfort to her that she didn't, although they were incredibly close. When we were all children, me and my siblings, our grandmother used to tell us about the prison camp, but she obviously didn't sit a bunch of children down and go, let me tell you about the time I was a prisoner of the Japanese. What she did was she told us this incredible story when we were very little about how our mother learnt to write with a stick in the sand and didn't wear a pair of shoes till she was 6 years old and never tasted bread and butter until she was 7 years old. And then gradually over the years, she would add a layer more of reality into it. And I think what that taught me about, you know, how a story has so many entry points and so many connection points you can tell. And you, it was entirely possible to tell an uplifting, happy story about the prison camp. And like you were saying, with the, you know, playing in the band on the ship, they held pantomimes at Christmas. The nuns in the camp made presents for the children. So there were joyous moments.
And you find a way to
keep going. That's how you kept, you know. And
well, it's still your life, isn't it?
Exactly.
The life is going on, even if you're
you
in
have
those...
children.
Exactly. Exactly so. So yes, it did teach me a great deal about storytelling and about truths and how you open doors in stories for your readers.
There's got to be a book in there.
Yes, definitely.
Conversation later.
I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And you've actually got a few of these cards.
I have a series of them. But... So later there were some free text postcards. So here's an example of one. Dear Father, I'm quite well, fit and well. Also, family when last seen. Hope to hear from you soon. Hope you are all well. Love to everybody.
How few words can convey so much. I love the fact he bothered to put in the word quite.
I know.
I'm quite fit and well.
Yes, yes.
And but then, that means very, doesn't it?
It does. And because here's a later one. Dear Father, am still very well. Also, Babs, his wife, and Susan, his daughter, when last seen.
That dangles, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Seen. And, you know, they didn't see one another very often at all. In fact, they were brought together by the Japanese propaganda machine because they were picked as being a very attractive family and they were photographed. Oh. And this photograph that exists is a tremendous
lie.
Your book
gets better, actually.
Yeah,
so they're photographed together, but of course they're in gendered
camps. Of course, put into clothes that they weren't their own, that were taken off them afterwards. My grandmother was given makeup,
which was
then washed off her face afterwards. Yes,
goodness,
and they printed millions of them and put them up all over the cities and villages in Japan. The news,
to
because it was dishonourable to treat your prisoners badly.
But their image then became famous.
Yes, yes. It's an extraordinary picture because they're very beautiful, my grandmother, my grandparents, and they're gazing into each other's eyes. And there's my mother sitting in the middle, aged about four, staring right out at the camera. And the truth is absolutely in her face. You can see, suddenly you know there's something wrong with the picture when you see her eyes. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Astonishing. Gosh, well, I'm not surprised, actually, because of the intensity of both of what you do for a living, that you brought such good family cards. It's very, very interesting. From the serious and the touching to the faintly ridiculous, another card from me from the past postcards.
I love these cards.
So we can only leaven the atmosphere. But this is a card of... actually, you'll recognise this, Sarah.
Is it Liverpool?
It is Liverpool.
I believe it is.
Liverpool, indeed. No, you were quite right.
Big expanse of water.
Yes.
Like a building behind. Yeah, exactly.
Slightly more believable blue sky, marginally.
Actually, but I would still say it's pretty touched up. You've probably seen that sky is probably featured on hundreds of cards.
Postcards, yes.
This is from 1977. And it was sent to the Isle of Man from Robert and Linda. Now, what did I find interesting about this one? It's from one of my favourite publishers, actually, Colour Master. And it said, arrived at my sister's to find they had written the car off in an accident. Cut by glass, mainly. Makeup covered the cuts for the wedding day, but everyone was shook up.
Wow.
It's all there.
It's all there, isn't it?
We love
that terrific
short story in 14
words. Who sabotaged the car? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Was it someone that was disgruntled about the wedding? There's a story there.
Oh, well, a typical crime writer. You see, not an accident, but a sabotage.
Oh, definitely.
There you go.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard podcast, and my guests today are historical biographer Claire Mully and crime writer Sarah Hillary. Now, Claire, what's the second card you've got for us today? It's another family one, I think?
It is, yes. I mean, it's a very silly one. It's from my father, and I've actually got my first ever postcard from him and the last letter he wrote me.
Gosh.
He died about 4 or 5 years ago. He was such a lovely guy, very gentle. He was a chemist. Anyhow, so it's very silly. My little postcard from the 70s, I'm obviously on Brownie camp, and he says, "My dear Claire, I'm told you are in Disneyland. Wouldn't, spelt like wood, wouldn't it be nice to see Pinocchio? He's a chip off the old block." So total 1970s dad, but his little, you know, terrible word puns, which you know, love daddy, sum him up. But I thought it might be nice to just sort of mention my last letter I ever got from him as well.
Absolutely.
Because he was a chemist and he absolutely adored chemistry, as you will see, I had sent him this book that I'd found from, I think it was 1900, The Story of the Wandering Atoms.
Ooh,
Dad was always very disappointed that my brother, my sister and I, none of us showed any interest in chemistry at all.
I see.
He spent ages on our plastic breakfast table cloth, you know, describing fungiform rings and things to us, trying to get us hooked. But anyhow.
You wasted your time with history.
Yes, exactly. He says, "My dear Claire," you see, this is both, you see, it's history and chemistry in one book, hence they're sending it to him. "My dear Claire, I have been pleasurably occupying myself reading The Story of the Wandering Atoms. Its romantic title chimes in with my own feelings when I first decided to be a chemist. There was a desire to make attractive coloured crystals and liquids. This I obtained in my PhD by making complex amines, brackets, remember aniline dyes made by Perkin." Well, obviously not. Of course, I don't remember any of that.
How could you forget such a
blah,
thing?
Blah, blah, blah. He talks about the book and then he ends. "I first began to study chemistry in the early 1940s, and this is much closer to the publishing date of this little book, 1900, than today is to the 1940s.
Oh, gosh, yes.
It makes me quite antediluvian. I cover the discovery of short-lived free radicals, contact with people who achieved the first self-sustaining nuclear reaction in Chicago University's swimming pool, the first man who attempted to make life fragments from natural sources, right up to the manufacture of polyethylenes, especially polypropylene. Love, Dad."
Oh, wow. Well,
you couldn't fit that on a postcard.
It's so, well, I think you could. I think sometimes postcards tell you a lot in what they don't say. The messages,
yes,
what they say, what they choose to leave
absolutely
out.
Yes.
So he doesn't bother with the fripperies about it. This is his heart speaking to my heart, his love of chemistry, his passion for that, trying to engage with a little bit of my love of history. And then there's no bothering about how are you and any of that boring stuff. Love, Dad.
Well, that's nice. I mean, I always say that the fact that you've written to someone, that in itself says you care enough to do that. So that bit's taken care of, really.
Yep.
You know, and then you can get down to the meat of it.
Absolutely. If you know someone well enough, you can sit in silence and enjoy that. And this is his sort of immediacy of contact, which I loved.
And when you're researching your books, do you must come across correspondence. Do you come across postcards or is it more letters? And it must be a great way of finding out detail and emotion.
I mean, the written word is so important. And like you say, I mean, letters and postcards, they're no good for facts, really. I mean, two people present a completely different picture of the same incident, but they are fantastic for emotion. I always think of letters as being the fossils of emotion. You know, they kind of that last residue of that intangible thing that disappears in time otherwise. And so they're incredibly useful for me when I'm doing my research. Now, I'm a very nosy person, got a perfect job because it enables me to read people's diaries and letters. I don't collect them. I'm not a collector, but I do collect the contents of them.
Yeah, you mine them.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So, and I've found so many extraordinary letters and little notes on small bits of squared paper that were written. Christina Scarbeck, I found, when I first started researching her, there were only 3 known letters in her hand.
Really?
And now we've got about 12 or 13, depending if you count this little scrappy one.
And is this because you've been digging through the archives?
Because I've been digging in there, yeah. And And one of them was just written on squared notepaper. And we don't know, I've asked all the experts, we don't know if this is sort of coding paper that the special agents use or French school child's maths paper. I mean, it's an incredibly flimsy squared paper.
Could have been.
Yes. And she's managed to get up into the Alps. And she, one of her achievements, one of her many achievements, she made the first contact between the French resistance and the Italian partisans on the other side of the Alps. And she heard the sounds of a gun battle and she kind of managed to manoeuvre around. So she came from the correct direction. And in fact, she was nearly captured, but unpinned some hand grenades and held them and said, unless you back off, I'm going to let these go, and managed to then get the pins back in and carried on. And made contact with the leader of the Italian partisans. And she noted on this scrap of paper that I found their need for ammunition, shoes and packed meat, which is what she relayed back to the French to provide that first contact and what they needed for support. So little things like that.
It's the details, isn't it?
It's wonderful. But, I mean, her letters are extraordinary as well. I mean,
why? What about
incredible
them?
Bravery. Well, it's that thing, isn't it, about letters. They tell you the content, but they also tell you the character of the person. Yeah. So... got one
what
here.
Language was she writing? Was she writing in Polish?
Well, she was Polish born, but she spoke perfect French and very good English.
Right.
Although not completely perfect English. So this is a little bit from a letter she wrote in March 1945, so right at the end of the war. She wasn't just Britain's first female special agent, or the first woman to serve Britain as a female special agent. She was also the longest serving agent, male or female, in the war. Wow. She served in three different theatres, extraordinarily. And right at the end of the war, she's desperate to go back into service. She writes, "For God's sake, do not strike my name from the firm," which is what insiders called SOE. Mm. "Remember that I'm always too pleased to go and do anything for it. Maybe you find out I could be useful getting people out of camps and prisons in Germany just before they get shot. I should love to do it. And I like to jump out of a plane even every day." I was told off for giggling in the National Archives when I picked out that one. But she's in absolute earnest. But this letter is also interesting because it contains a number of little personal sort of things as well. So she writes to Perks Kahani. I don't know if you speak Polish, but it's sort of Kahani is my dearest, my darling Perks. And the book is called The Spy Who Loved because she was a very passionate woman. I mean, she loved adventure and adrenaline. She loved men. She had numerous lovers, two husbands. Perks possibly included in that, or Harold Perkins, as we should properly call him. But above all, she loved freedom. Freedom for her country, Poland, for the Allies, and also freedom for herself personally. So she was fairly ahead of her times in many ways. But she also suffered from an awful lot of sexism. People weren't expecting women. I mean, she was the first woman and only taken on because they desperately needed her unique services. But here, even in this last letter, after 6 years of putting her life on the line to serve Britain, she feels compelled to write the caveat, "Apologies for my bad English. Remember to tell them I'm an honest and decent Polish girl." You know, she would get the George Cross, she would get the OBE, the French gave her the Croix de Guerre with one star, and yet she feels compelled to always be making the case at that low level as well. Yeah. Extraordinary stuff.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, and it must feel strange when you first come across those letters. You feel like you're hearing their voice?
Oh, very much so. You know, her Polish accent. And apparently she used her voice very much, so she would play on that accent when she wanted to seduce a man or whatever.
Really? Playing up to being the kind of exotic spy.
Yeah, but a lot of the time it's almost she writes very prosaic because she isn't using foreign language because she doesn't have that in her bag. But also that kind of reflects how she would play up and play down. I mean, the greatest skill of the women's special agents, it's not being the honey trap or the femme fatale. That's how we always seem to imagine female special agents or women in the resistance in these romantic terms as above all beautiful. Mm. But actually their greatest skill often was the fact that they're seen as anonymous. They're not seen.
Right.
They're disregarded.
Yes.
That women could travel around Nazi-occupied Germany and weren't automatically suspect and going to be checked. So Christina was travelling around. In fact, once she's on the back of a motorbike with a young man driving into what would become the Battle of Vercors in southwest France. And she has got a backpack on her back and they get stopped and the man is checked fully and she just sits there twiddling with some grass, chewing on a bit of straw, you know, and they don't bother with her. And she, under in her rucksack, she's got some cheese sandwiches and under that she has these hand grenades. But she's not seen as worthy for an examination. So,
yes. Very good. Amazing. And we're going to see it on the big screen, I'm sure. It's got to come.
Well, I do hope so, yes. Well, Angelina Jolie has said she's interested.
Oh, how amazing.
It's currently optioned to Universal, but...
We shall see.
Yeah, oh, it's a long journey, isn't it?
But, yes. But many a slip.
It should be there. Lovely it should idea. Be there. I'm queuing up for the premiere. It's going to be great.
Good, good.
Now, Sarah, what's your final card you've got for us today?
So I've brought a card, some of which I can't, well, most of which I can't decipher because it's written...
Today we're not getting silly cards of cats or anything. Those are really good historical cards.
No, now this card doesn't... It has a picture of a very beautiful Edwardian mother and her daughter, but it's not... The pictures are not of my grandmother and
just
her
a
grandmother.
Archetype,
but it was
symbolic of.
Yes. It was sent from my great great grandmother to my grandmother.
What date are we talking?
It's very specific. May 7th, 1919.
Okay.
So my grandmother at this time wasn't quite 4 years old. She will be 4 years old in August 1919. 3 years old. I tell a lie. She's 3 years old in 1919. So, and it's addressed to Miss Florence Adams, which was my grandmother's name, Waverley Mansions in Calcutta in India, which is where my Gosh. Grandmother grew up.
Amritsar massacre time then, May 1919.
Yes, very near. I mean, they were grandmother's father was worked for the railways, as a lot of British people did. But so her grandmother is back home in. I can't quite read where she is, but it's somewhere in the southwest. But I love the opening of this postcard. This is why I brought it along. So it begins, "My darling little Florrie," and then in inverted commas, "Grandma's little queen," which I think is lovely. And then obviously you're writing to a three-year-old, so it's just basically hoping that mummy and daddy are well and that can't wait to see her again and all of those good things. And, you know, with very much love, your loving grandma at the end. My grandmother grew up in India, and then she came back to England to finish her education, as a lot of young people of that generation did. And it was when she was travelling back out to her family in India after she had finished her education that she met my grandfather on a ship. He was going out.
Stuck on a ship together.
Yes, he was heading out to take up his post as the aide-de-camp to the governor of what was then British North Borneo.
Oh, good prospect.
From St. Peter's College in Oxford. And my grandmother was playing cards. My grandmother was quite a bit younger than him. So I suppose she must have been at this time around about 19, 20. She was on the lower deck of the ship playing cards with her friends and her family. And my grandfather was on a higher deck on the ship. And he looked down and watched. He saw she was cheating at cards. And that was when he fell in love with her. So the story goes.
Really?
Yes,
nice.
Yes. So they were married in they were married in the UK, but then they went back out to take up his post and lived in Sandakan. That's when my mother was born and christened, and they didn't quite get out in time.
So I was going to say, there's a connection between your two postcards.
Exactly.
You've got Borneo and
exactly
didn't you say Sarawak in the other?
That's exactly so. So my grandfather was in the, you know, he was, you know, a civil servant, effectively, my grandmother lived the strange life of a colonial wife, I suppose not that different from the life of a colonial young lady in India, but very different with the with the war coming, of course. It was a very different environment, whereas I think in Calcutta in 1919 it had its own problems, but it wasn't about to...
So they'd have been out there. Isn't Mata Hari out there at that point?
Yeah, is she in...
Maybe she's come back to France, but she'd been dancing
out there.
Dutch husband, of
yes,
course.
Yes, yes. But no, one of the things I loved about the... it's like you were saying about diaries and letters having, you know... the history of the lives and the emotions as well. I found a series of, when I was researching this part of my family's history, I found a series of fascinating accounts of what happened in the prison camp. A lot of them are in the Imperial War Museum, as you might expect. Yeah. And there was one that was kept by a gentleman in the military who was a captain, and he was basically a record of the way they were treated. And I imagine it was deliberately kept in the event of a war crimes and a trial after the war. So he was recording things such as they'd been promised bananas and no bananas were delivered, or they were given half a banana when they'd been promised. It was very, very specific. And also
you know, various other ways in which the Japanese might have made promises and then not kept them, or behaved in a way that he felt. Mm. And they're very angry diaries. There's nothing personal in them, but the anger in them is quite extraordinary, just from the listing of things that they were promised and not. And then there's a diary by a young missionary who is also imprisoned, but he tries very hard in his diaries to take the view that, you know, to see the good in everyone, even in their Japanese guards, which is quite interesting. But my favourite diary of all is one by Nurse Hilda Bates, and she, partly because she mentions my grandmother and my mother, and the children in the camp. So that you were talking about women's stories that aren't necessarily very well known, and the women in the camp, although there was the Tenko TV series.
Of course,
I mean,
yes.
It's, you know, the children in the camp haven't really had their story told, because there were virtually no children in that. I think deliberately conscious choice by the makers of Tenko. But so she's recorded this wonderful diary. It's got things in it like, you know, the last part of my towel disintegrated this morning and had to shake myself dry like a dog. and, you know, there's it packed into that is obviously a huge story of hardship.
So
you know, but she's managed to condense it into this beautifully human, almost joyful
spirit of her. Mm.
Spirit, absolutely. But and then a couple of just very spooky things that happened. So a friend of mine was writing all the way through the war. And don't forget, people who wrote diaries or letters in the prison camp, they were risking punishment by death. Mm. But they felt so compelled to write these diaries. You can understand why the military might have felt compelled to write an account of how they were being treated. But for somebody like Nurse Hilda Bates to keep a diary under pain of severe punishment, if not death, is quite extraordinary. She felt compelled to write these diaries. And a friend of mine's sister was writing letters home all the time to her sister in England, only to discover when they finally reached home that she died in the Blitz, not knowing. And then a series of letters had been photocopied and faxed to me by a friend of mine. I mean, I went to look at them the other day when I was digging out these postcards from the camp, and they had all the ink on them has completely vanished.
Oh, no.
So I've got a series of fax
lost letters. Yes, that's fascinating. We have
extraordinary.
I've had all sorts of
yes, really spooky. The ghosts of letters. Just you can see the indents.
You could probably put them under something.
Yes,
under
shoulders. Yes,
with your forensic experience.
Yes, so the crime connections.
Yes, next time you're researching for the crime story.
Slip
one more thing.
Well.
Yes, absolutely.
But I love that. I had a. I've been looking into. I'm writing a proposal for a possible new book now, which I can't say too much about. But there's a family story in the Second World War, and I was with the family, fantastically, and they got all these yellow stars, all sorts of things you can see, and some letters and diaries and things. And then they said, where are the 200 letters, that collection? We don't know. So everyone's looking, aunts and uncles, and they're just missing. And then it turned out that this is from a gentleman who died 2 years ago, and a German historian had been in touch with him, and they'd obviously made a relationship of trust, and he'd sent these letters over.
Oh, good.
So I was like, oh, great, fantastic. So I managed to trace her, and I was slightly, you know, some trepidation, because I thought, oh, we're writing the same story from, but, you know, we'll see how this goes. It's early days, so, you know, fine. So I got in touch with her. Well, I tried to, only discovered that she was elderly, and very sadly, she died 6 months before I reached her. But the letter came back, I managed to get in touch with her sister. And but that took some time to track her down. And eventually I got in touch with her sister. And I said, look, I'm so sorry, forgive me. It's now sort of 9 months after her sister. I said, do you know what happened to any of these documents? It means so much for the family. And she said, you know, because there's a sort of famous person connection here, she said she looked for an archive to donate them to, but nobody was interested. She didn't know what to do with them. She didn't have contacts for any family or anything. So she said, if you had got in touch with me a week earlier, I would have given them to you.
No.
But I've just cleared out my sister's flat to rent it, and they're all bagged up on the street for recycling. So a friend of mine who lives in Berlin, I said, can you just go? So he took a plane, had to go into Switzerland, and then he had to get a train back into the other end of Germany. He got to the street as the recycling van was coming along, and he swagged the bag.
I got it.
I don't know what's in it yet. I'm yet to find out what we've got, but he's got the bag. So
he's got the right bag.
So you've got the prologue for the book.
Yes,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly.
Here's how we got there.
Fantastic.
Oh, wow.
But sometimes we, you know, there's another story about losing letters. There's one that I particularly like about, in my last book, The Women Who Flew for Hitler. There were only two female test pilots because obviously it was seen as a very masculine field of flight. But these women were exceptionally talented and they were needed. And one of them is the better known Hannah Wright, who was a fanatical Nazi, as her later letters I found that she sent, including postcards, to a private archive.
well, to a friend in England, they're now with someone, a private archive, really revealed. Because in letters, you're quite candid. If you think they're private letters, they're not going to come out. And they're not an interrogation report or something. So she writes, you know, she's deeply anti-Semitic and a Holocaust denier to the end. Horrendous. Talks about people's racial burden. And it's just awful stuff, but very telling. But there is another letter that she touched, which hasn't made the historical record because she was one of the last people to leave Hitler's bunker in April 1945. And she was entrusted. She had last orders from the Führer. And she was given Joseph and Magda Goebbels' last ever letters, which she carried out to safety, which are now on record, just before they killed themselves. And Eva Braun gave her last ever letter, which ostensibly was written to her sister, but in fact was written for, you know, for the Nazi history record. She was writing for posterity, Eva Braun. But Hannah didn't like Eva. She thought she was a flighty, flippity gibbet who'd changed her clothes too much and was slightly embarrassing and difficult. So she read this letter. She later said it was so vulgar and so theatrical. She thought she didn't think this should be in the great annals of Nazi history. So she tore it up and threw it out the window. So it went off into space. So we don't have that one. But it's a lovely... She kind of remembered... Eva had written about how perfect her life was with the Führer and to die beside him would, you know, complete her happiness sort of thing. But Hannah just thought that was rather shameful. So she
too tacky for the Nazis.
So sometimes lost letters are also telling a story.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially if you know they exist. That's unusual, though, really.
Yes.
Normally the loss is just a blank, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. But although sometimes you can tell in a record, clearly things haven't been stated or certain dates are missing, and that will give you an idea of something was happening.
And often I see postcard correspondences, and of course they're one-sided.
You don't get the returns.
Or in fact, they're all coming in. They're all incoming. So they're all addressed to the same person, but they're from multiple hands. Which is very hard to really get much coherence or meaning from that until you get both sides of it.
Well,
thank you very much, both of you, for sharing these really interesting cards and taking us back through the 20th century, actually. I'm thrilled that you share them with us and for the listeners at home. I'm sure they enjoyed them too. All these cards will be available to look at on the website, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, including one last one in the past postcard style from me, which you'll probably have seen on Twitter or in the book. And this is a card, Harbour View, from 1976.
The 70s are rich, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I tend to get ones from the 70s, I suppose, because that was the height of the modern postcard sending. It was the Silver Age, if you like. It's Lynmouth in Devon, a very typical holiday place people go to. And it's from someone called Mona, I think, sent to Southend on Essex, in Essex. Una, as in Una Stubbs, but I don't think it's from her. And it says, I've discovered that my son-in-law has similar tastes to mine. Beer in pubs with fruit machines.
Oh.
So I think the wedding is going to be fine.
Yeah, yes.
The family will survive.
Yes,
that's a
definitely.
Good family.
Yeah,
yes.
the same interests across the generations.
Excellent.
Right, before we let Claire and Sarah back to their writing desks, I've got one more postcard for you both. It's customary for us to end the programme on one of these.
Ooh.
I don't know if you've seen one of these before.
Oh, can you play
beautiful.
It?
Beautiful.
Is it a record?
I think you might be correct.
Extraordinary. Look at that.
I've got two writers here. Could you describe the image, please?
It's a beautiful little Labrador dog with a hole through the centre of his face.
It's with a horrendous pink puppy with a plastic donut toy.
He's not pink, admittedly. The background is pink. And he's got a rubber ring and a rubber bone. And I don't know, an upturned woven basket, which looks as if it might be where he's going to be going back into after he's sung his song of happy birthday, or barked it, maybe.
Well, Charlie's been helping us out in the other room. Perhaps she could see if we can make this play.
Oh, wouldn't that be superb?
Oh, yes.
Crackle.
Beautiful crackle. Oh.
Here we go. Not bad for a dog.
It's very. That dog has got some talent.
I thought it was going to be how much is that dog in the window. This is better.
No, you should know by now. There's very little connection between one side and the other side of the postcard. Right. It's never the same.
I was going to say, it's not been through the post, though, has it? Otherwise, it would be completely unplayable.
Must have been sent in a post, in an envelope. Maybe.
Yes, definitely.
Or bought and never sent.
Yes.
I like it. You see, we wouldn't do that anymore, would we? We'd just have a barcode that you'd scan and take to.
And you'd never bother.
It's
never
the same.
Well, as the Labrador puppy spins round at 45 RPM, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, Claire Mully and Sarah Hillary. Thank you both.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me, at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardourstudios.co.uk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.